Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal, Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week I try to bring you exciting new guests to talk about various aspects of UFOs and the Paranormal. And tonight's no different. I got a great show for you guys. I hope you enjoyed our show last week when our guest was Jacqueline Lloyd, and we talked about 2012 prophecies and upcoming earth changes and a lot of things like that. So it was a pretty exciting show, and I had a lot of fun. But tonight, we've got something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite subjects, ghosts. I just love the subject of ghosts. Having seen one myself, I think I have a particular affinity towards this subject. And our guests tonight are actually experts, so we're really in for quite a treat. They have written a brand new book. It's called Scarizona, sort of a play on words over Arizona. It's the haunted places in Arizona. It's called Scarizona, Travel Guide to Arizona's Spookiest Spots. And our guests, we actually have two of them tonight, so that's really exciting. Katie Mullaly is one of them. And Katie has actually been investigating paranormal for a very long time, pretty much since she could walk and talk. And what started out as a childhood interest has now grown into a serious pursuit that has led her to intensely study this subject and, to our benefit, to write about it. And our other guest, his name is Patrick Olde, that's O-H-L-D-E, and he actually grew up in a haunted house. We're going to have to hear more about that. And that's, I guess, what started his interest. And he actually started taking paranormal classes while attending the University of Arizona, where he got a bachelor's degree in psychology. So we're actually going to have a scientist speaking with us tonight, which I think is really a benefit in this particular subject. And they together actually formed their own investigative group, which we'll talk more about. And they have written this really amazing book, which I have in my hands, called Scarizona. It's just been released by Shipper Books. It's 256 pages and has got lots of really interesting photographs in there. I mean, just some stunning pictures of orbs and actually apparitions and things like this. So this is really a well-put-together book, and I'm very, very excited to have our guests on tonight. So Katie, Patrick, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having us. It's good to be here.
Oh, we appreciate it. Oh, it's really my honor. You know, I've read a lot of books on ghosts, I have to tell you, and yours I really particularly enjoyed because I think it works on several levels, actually. I mean, it's more than just your typical, like, travel guide book, because what's really interesting is you guys went to all these places. You're not just armchair researchers.
That's correct.
Yeah, most ghost researchers, I think, pretty much just do armchair research. At least most books published about ghosts are like that. So your book was really refreshing. And what I found so amazing about it was that you had no fear of giving your own impressions about what you experienced. So I thought that was just a blast and just really, I mean, some of the stories you guys tell are riveting and not a little bit scary.
That's actually very cool to hear. I mean, I'm really glad that you liked it, and I'm glad because that's kind of what we were trying to convey. So it sounds like we really hit the nail on the head. So I'm really glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, the book's very readable. It's very exciting. And like I said, I just love your firsthand stories. And it's one thing to quote another person, but to hear your own actual investigations firsthand, oh, it's outstanding. So let's just get right into it. I guess, Katie, let's start with you. How did you get involved in the paranormal and ghost research?
Well, officially, we actually had we had a website where we wrote, it was really more like fiction about the paranormal, and it was very satirical in nature, and that was probably, 17 years ago. So that's really when we really officially started to pursue it, but it really wasn't a serious pursuit at that time. It was probably more like 10 years ago when Patrick and I started to really kind of gear ourselves towards doing actual investigations and with the intent of eventually writing about it. So probably seriously about a decade.
Wow. So growing up, did you believe in ghosts then?
Oh, I absolutely believe in ghosts. I've always believed in ghosts, and I've never for one second doubted the existence.
You're lucky. I didn't. And, you know, even after I saw a ghost, I didn't believe it. And it was a real shock for me when I found out all this stuff was real.
Wow.
So, yeah, you're definitely blessed. So, Patrick, what about you? Were you skeptical of ghosts growing up?
Well, I wasn't exactly skeptical, but when I was a little kid growing up in my house, I used to see a shadow of a person go into my parents' bedroom. And I would investigate a little bit, like, just to see if it was one of them or whatever. But I just thought I was crazy for a long time. I didn't know, you know, it was a ghost or anything like that. My parents decided not to tell me that the place was haunted because they thought it would scare me. So I just thought I was nuts for like 10 years before they finally, you know, mentioned it to me. And then I felt a lot better about it. But I was never really skeptical. I just didn't really know very much about it when I was little. But that's kind of... what made me interested in it once I found out that that's what I was seeing all that time.
Well, what moved you from, you know, just being kind of curious about this phenomenon to, you know, becoming a professional researcher?
It was when I was in college studying psychology. There was a parapsychology class, and I, you know, had already been interested in it. And as Katie said, we were doing the website and that sort of thing. So I thought it would be cool to find out what was going on scientifically with it and that sort of thing. So I took the class, and I got invited to go on some investigations with that group, and I did that for quite some time before Katie and I branched out on our own to start doing our own investigations. But that was what it was just being able to go to that class and kind of learn more about the scientific aspects of it.
Right. So you formed your own group, actually, is that right? Your own.
Yes, we have our own group. It's called Wailing Banshee Investigations.
Nice title. I like it.
Thank you.
What inspired that title?
Well, going back to that original website, the satirical one, we all created our own characters, and the name that I picked for my character was actually Banshee St. Quinlan. So I decided to just, when that website ended and we kind of went off and, you know, into the more serious pursuit, I decided that I would just take that name and incorporate it into the name of the group. So that's where that came from.
You know, I love the title of your book, Scarezona. I mean, that's really, really nice.
Thank you.
How did you get that title?
It was actually somewhat of an epiphany because when we were putting together the actual proposal for the book, I was walking around my neighborhood, and it sort of hit me because I was desperately trying to think of a catchy name, and it just sort of came to me, and I was like, that's funny, I like that. So I didn't actually think it would stick, you know, for the final title, but I'm glad it did because I like it.
So what prompted you or what inspired you guys to write this book?
Well, actually, I've been wanting to be a writer for a long time. I've been, writing for as long as I can remember, and my wife actually came across a solicitation for paranormal books from Schiffer, and she sent me the link for it. So I forwarded that along to Katie and said, hey, you know, we should look into doing this. And so we got on the phone with each other. I was actually living in Arkansas at the time, so we got on the phone with each other that weekend and had a proposal that we sent in on that following Monday, and then we ended up getting the book off of the proposal we sent in.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, Schiffer books, they're great. I mean, I think they're probably working their way towards being the largest publisher of regional ghost books out there.
I think that you're probably right. There are so many of them now I see on the Schiffer website, and it's actually very cool. I want to read all of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, it's a perfect niche that hasn't yet been filled.
They're really great to work with as well. I've really enjoyed the whole process, so.
Oh, yeah, and they put together a really nice book. So I'm really impressed with your book. I mean, the graphics and everything, it looks great.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about what ghosts are for people, who are not that familiar with the subject. Because there's different theories, And, you know, there's different ways to experience ghosts. So, to you guys, I mean, what is a ghost?
Well, it depends. You know, like you said, there's a lot of different theories, but from the kind of more scientific standpoint, the general consensus is that there's three different types of activity primarily. You know, there's the apparition that's just the kind of the spirit of a dead person, the way that most people would kind of think of a ghost. You know, it usually shows up as a shadow or a silhouette or something like that, and it kind of interacts with the environment a little bit, those sorts of things. It seems to have some sort of, you know, anima or whatever to just, you know, be able to interact. And then the second one is what's kind of called a haunting, which is sort of a recorded sequence of events on a place, and it just sort of repeats over and over again, and you can kind of tell the difference between that and an apparition insofar as, like, the haunting will have, like, the people you see will have clothes on and stuff like that. You know, you don't have a pair of overalls, don't have a soul, so they're not going to be represented or anything like that if it's an actual apparition. So when you start seeing someone carrying a lantern around or something, you can tell it's a haunting. And then the third type is the poltergeist, which is, you know, German for noisy spirit, but it's basically where objects are moved around and thrown across the room, or bookcases fall down, those sorts of things. The consensus amongst, you know, most scientists on that is that it's actually not a ghost as much as it's, you know, psychokinetic energy, or like telekinetic energy, if you are more familiar with the term, from one certain person, from like a, you know, person usually like going through puberty or going through stress or something like that, that's actually causing the activity. So it will sometimes be around when there's a spirit or a haunting based on the stress that causes, but typically poltergeist activity is considered to be kind of separate, you know, its own little thing. So.
Right. Well, would you say you could tell the difference between, like, a live haunting, an actual, you know, spirit or ghost, and a residual type haunting, because the live ghost can interact with you, whereas the, you know, the one that plays back, sort of like a recording, doesn't really interact with the witness?
Yeah, you know, and a lot of times, though, you'll see, you know, both of them at the same time. You know, there'll be you know, an actual apparition operating at the same time that there's a, you know, one of the more residual sorts of situations. But,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty easy to tell the difference between the two.
Which would you say is more common? Just, you know, your opinion.
From what I've seen, it's probably the haunting or the residual energy. That tends to be what people report more often than not. Actually, the apparition is fairly rare. You know, you don't really get to run into those that often. So,
right.
I'd say definitely the haunting.
You know, what I loved about your book and the way you guys do these investigations is you're really professional about it, and you're bringing all this equipment. You're walking through these places separately, recording your impressions. So, like, what are some of the tools that you guys use when you go to one of these haunted places to investigate?
Well, excuse me. My favorite is the digital camera, because that gives you immediate gratification when you take pictures. So that's my favorite thing to use. But we also take in the EMF detector so that, you know, we can measure the electromagnetic energy and see if it, you know, corresponds with any of the digital camera evidence. We also take in a voice recorder. So if we can get EVP, then that would, you know, those three things together are primarily what we use. Of course, we do take temperature readings and that sort of thing. But beyond that, I mean, we keep it very simple, and, you know, we don't drag cords everywhere, and we don't set up big computer screens or anything like that, because I just, you know, we like to keep it very low-key, and that way it's not as intimidating for people.
Right.
So, both people that want to investigate and also the people that are experiencing the activity. So we keep it very, you know, very unintimidating.
Right. Well, I also like the fact that you don't discount your own impressions, which I think is, I mean, really one of the most interesting parts of your book.
Yeah, that's kind of the backbone of what we do. It's based off of Gertrude Schmidler's method of you know, sensory replication, where we're basically trying to you know, just repeat the sort of activity, you know, going as blind as possible and see if we can get the same impressions that somebody else did, which I find particularly compelling evidence, because if we don't know what there is and we go in and have the same experience, then it's a pretty good bet that there's something going on versus just, you know, just trying to take just particular readings or whatever, you know.
Right. Well, do you have to be psychic? I mean, would you say that you guys are psychic when you're having psychic
experiences? No, I mean, I think that it's sort of like anything else where you get better at it over time. I think that everybody can do it. It's just learning what to look for and what to not to discount, honestly, because there have been so many times when they've gone on walkthroughs or something and, you know, I'll feel something weird or Katie will feel something weird, and our first impression is just to kind of disregard it. You know, it's like, oh, that's just the wind, or that's just this or that or whatever. But it'll end up being something more significant. And obviously, when you're doing it, you have to look for, you know, other sources of that, you know, like other confounds that maybe, you know, if you get a certain chill or something like that, you might be standing over a, you know, air conditioning vent or something. But if none of that's there and you get those impressions, then it tends to be pretty compelling. But I think the biggest hurdle for people is to learn what to pay attention to, because I think in life we tend to just sort of ignore, you know, little things, and you can't really do that when you're investigating.
All right. Well, is there any danger, you think, to getting this stuff? I mean, does it scare you at all?
Well, you know, there have been times when I've been a little bit freaked out, but I don't think that there is anything dangerous about it. Now, I don't necessarily say that over anything that is demonic or any, you know, that type of thing, which we honestly don't get into very much, just for that very reason. But if you're dealing just with a haunting or an apparition or poltergeist activity, I suppose there is a danger that something, you know, like if a cabinet door swings open, it could hit you in the head, but that's really probably as scary as it would ever get, or as dangerous as it would ever get, so.
Right, well, that's what I always tell people. I mean, I tell them that ghosts are basically people, so, I mean, if you're scared of people, I mean, that's, do you know what I mean? They're just, I personally don't find it the subject very frightening, so. But some people
not do as well. But you know, occasionally there'll be some places where it's something freaky will happen, and it's just you can't really help yourself. But I tend to not be all that afraid of it at this point. I've just done it so much that, you know, now it's just sort of normal.
Right. So what types of places would you say are the most haunted? And I mean, you've got, it seems like there's a lot of hotels that end up being haunted. I don't know if that's because of their age or not, but you've definitely got a lot of hotels that you visited where you had some amazing experiences.
Well, in Arizona, I mean, it's just the history here. There are so many places that are still left standing from, you know, late 1800s, you know, early 1900s. So, you know, just the fact that they've been around for so long, there's bound to have some activity. They are bound to have some activity. And we focus actually a lot on hotels and some restaurants just because we want people to be able to go there themselves and experience it. Certainly there have been, you know, well, most of them have had some pretty significant evidence, and we've had some significant experiences there that, you know, I mean, it can be very intense at times, even, and not necessarily scary, just very intense.
Yeah, well, you know, I also love the fact that you give, you know, directions and addresses and phone numbers, because a lot of, you know, guidebooks don't do that, and I mean, you guys really went all out on this one. I love the photographs, particularly of all these orbs. Now, I mean, wow, that's just amazing how much activity you have actually caught on film. So,
we were actually pretty excited about it, too, because, you know, as you probably know, being in the field, if you go to an investigation and you take, you know, 500 pictures, you're lucky if you get a couple of them back that have anything in them. So we were very fortunate. And I have to give the photo credit to my husband, Michael. He did 99% of the, you know, photographing, except, of course, for the ones that he's actually in. I took those. But yeah, I have to kind of give a shout-out to him on that.
Right. So what would you say these orbs are? Are they just, I mean, are they just your typical human spirit wandering around?
Well, you know, there are so many schools of thought about what orbs are. I'm of the impression, and, you know, I may be in the minority on this, but I think they're just a, you know, collection of energy. So when you have orbs present, then that increases the likelihood that you have some significant paranormal activity. Now, of course, you can look at a picture, and if it has 1,000 of them in it, it's probably dust. So a lot of groups and a lot of television shows are now saying that orbs, you know, are nothing but dust. But I counter that with, why doesn't every picture I take have dust in it then? So, but yeah, I think it's really just the evidence of the presence of energy.
Well, when you're photographing these orbs, are you seeing something at the same time you're photographing it or sensing something? You know what I mean?
Oftentimes there's a sense that there's something there. You don't generally see it. I know there have been reports of people seeing flashes of light and that sort of thing. I've never had that experience, except, you know, not specifically with the orbs. So you generally don't see anything when you're taking the picture. You're just taking the picture based on a hunch or a feeling, or just in the spirit of being very thorough, and that's when you would get the evidence back. That's when you would see it on your screen.
Right. You know, another thing I loved about your book was how you paid attention to people's dreams, your own dreams and other people's who live in haunted houses. Because, you know, I've done a lot of ghost research myself, and I've always interviewed people about dreams and discovered definitely that there is a connection there. And in particular, I was fascinated by your reports of out-of-body experiences and astral projection-type effects, I guess. And because I think that's actually much more common in a haunted house than in places that aren't haunted, or a haunted hotel or whatever. So could you talk a little bit about that, or what that's like?
About the astral projection?
Yeah. It's really interesting.
It's really strange for me anyway. I used to be able to sort of do it whenever I wanted to when I was in high school, and I kind of had some bad experiences with it, so I'm not really like it that much, to be honest. But I have found that, like, when I go to haunted houses or, you know, hotel or whatever, and I'm sleeping there, it tends to happen a fair amount. Like, I don't normally ever have it if it's not a haunted place, and I'm not sure why that would be. But in particular, you know, Bisbee, Arizona seems to have a real, it's a real prevalence of that happening. Like, both of the, well, all the times that I've gone to stay there, in the two hotels I've stayed in, I've had, an out-of-body experience every single time. And
wow.
So it's sort of, for me anyway, it's just sort of like that creepy sort of weightless feeling where you're just sort of wandering around, but without any kind of real constraint to where you're going and that sort of thing. It just, I don't know even how to describe that particular feeling. It's just it's very bizarre.
And for me, actually, I don't particularly care for the sensation of astral projection. And I did have the one experience in Bisbee, which was, you know, it was really profound. And it was, you'd asked earlier if we'd ever been freaked out or frightened, but that's one thing that will do it for me. And I can remember it's that sort of feeling of being like you're half in and half out. I can't think of any other way to describe it. But and it was just almost, it's the loss of control feeling that I get with that, you know. And then plus, once I feel like you're very exposed to whatever energy is there when you are out of your body. So the whole thing just sort of, that's one of the things that I find most frightening about paranormal research. So.
Right. Well, my theory is that the ghosts are, you know, they found a way to make contact with people, and them being, you know, astral, in their astral body, and itself, you know. So when you're doing this astral projection, you're pretty much in the same state that ghosts are in. Would you say that that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, that would be fair to say, for sure. I mean, you know, one of the bad experiences that I had with it actually was encountering some, I don't know, they were just sort of black shadowy figures that seemed to try and keep me from coming back, and so that was not as fun as I would have liked. But, yeah, I think that's probably a fairly, fairly good assessment of what's going on.
All right. Well, I think it's just really interesting because, I mean, you hear a lot about all the different ways ghosts manifest and affect people and the environment, but there's not been a lot written about, you know, astral projection in ghosts. So that was really very interesting to me about your book. So what are some of the other ways that you would say ghosts manifest? Or, you know, some of the more unusual ways. I mean, we know about...
Well, you know, like you mentioned, the dreams, that's kind of strange. And you know, when I first started doing investigating, I didn't put much stock in the whole dream issue at all. So I kind of went and did an investigation at the Oliver House in Bisbee by myself, and I had this dream where I had a dream where this lady came up to me and introduced herself. She stood at the edge of my bed, introduced herself to me, and I was kind of talking to her in the dream. And in the middle of the dream, I realized I shouldn't be talking to a lady in a nightgown in my room. And so I kind of woke up with a start, and my friend that went with me described like me going from just sleeping on my side to lying across the bed, you know, awake, basically just like, you know, really startled. But I just kind of discounted it as a weird dream that I was having. But when I went back and talked to Bill Everest, who is my paranormal or parapsychology instructor, he asked me specifically, did you have any weird dreams in there? So I was like, well, yeah, here's this dream that I had. And he told me that I was the third person that had that exact dream in that room. And apparently the lady who was introducing herself to me was the former manager who had died. And so she, you know, likes to introduce herself to people staying in the room. And apparently subsequently since then, a few more people have had that same dream. So I became really sold on the whole dream thing after that, because that was just a really strange experience for me, you know.
Right. Well, you can't deny corroboration. And,
right,
you
know, exactly.
Speaking of which, that's what I love about your book, is the way you guys go through these haunted locations, recording your impressions, and then you compare them later together. And it's amazing how often you guys are getting the same impressions of these things.
Well, it is actually, we were very surprised with it, too. And that is also, we were talking about how it's the little things that, you know, you often dismiss, that we find out that we have all these similar sensations that are, you know, the same, and, you know, which I suppose is redundant, but, you know, we would make a little note or make a little X on the paper, and then we'd compare our maps that we'd drawn out, and they would be almost identical. So, you know, it was pretty interesting. In fact, we were at Casey Moore's Oyster House, which is one of the restaurants that we talk about in the book. And it was actually, I believe it was the first investigation that we did for the book. So we were really kind of keyed up about it, and this restaurant is near a college, so it's got a college crowd, and the manager he was really cool, and he told us all these great stories after the fact, of course. But there was one particular corner of the upstairs of the restaurant where Patrick and I both had these really intense sensations that, I mean, they weren't necessarily pleasant, but they were very intense. And so, like, right at that exact moment, one of the people from the bar downstairs came up, and they said, you know, did you get anything in that corner over there? And we said, yeah. And he goes, oh, that's where she was murdered. So, I mean, we had no backstory. So when he said that, we both just sort of, you know, our jaws dropped, and we're like, wow, cool. So that was a pretty significant, situation where we had almost exact sensations.
Right. Now, when you're doing these haunted investigations at these public locations, are you getting the permission of the owners? And, I mean, how do you go about, doing that?
Well, we did. We contacted all of these locations beforehand. And before we did any kind of investigating, we made sure that they were on board with it. And so we did contact them. And, you know, some of them, you know, there was one hotel specifically that wanted us to just be very respectful, you know, in anything that we were writing about. They just, you know, because they consider the ghosts that they have essentially as part of their family. So they didn't really want anything, very bad being written about them. So. But we
right.
do, and we would encourage other people to do the same. I wouldn't necessarily suggest going into a place. I mean, unless, if you rent a room in a hotel, you know, you can walk around, and I'm sure nobody would mind if you snapped some pictures or did your own thing. But if you are going to go in, just remember the golden rule and make sure that you're not stepping on anyone's toes or making a big, a fool of yourself, essentially, so.
Right. Well, some of these hotels actually seem to have no problem advertising their ghosts. As you wrote in your book, they have little, I guess you call them registers or diaries that people can fill out their experiences with. Is that right?
Yeah, there were most of the places that we went to actually had some sort of, a lot of times in the guest register, people would write, would write things about their experiences, but there were some places that would actually just have a book of ghost stories that they would keep behind the counter, and you can pull them out and show them to you, or if you have a story, you can add them to those, and that was really exciting to see, you know, that they kind of embraced it like that. I mean, most of the places we went to were willing to talk about it, and some of the people that you'll run into that work at the places will be kind of skeptical about it and that sort of thing, but by and large, most of the places we went to were really open about their ghosts and wanted to talk about it. You can ask them questions, or you can check out the little ghost logs and that sort of thing. So, all the places that we have in the book anyway are very investigation friendly. You know, you can just kind of go there and talk to people and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, it's fascinating, you know, taking the journey along with you in your book, visiting all these locations. I mean, even if you were just traveling to visit, you know, old architecture and ancient historical sites, it would be interesting. But, you know, coupled with this paranormal aspect, it's really fascinating. And I mean, so the type of ghosts in Arizona, would you say that they're different from, say, another location, you know, like on the East Coast or, you know, wherever?
I don't think they're necessarily different in terms of, you know, what they are and that sort of thing, but I think probably if it was an apparition, it might act a bit differently depending on what sort of, you know, person they were before. I mean, you know, out here you get a lot of, gunfighters and that sort of business. There were people, yeah, there was a lot of violence in Arizona, particularly around, like, Tombstone and some of the mining communities and that sort of thing. So, you might get a different quality of ghost, if you will, but, I mean, I think that they're all pretty much the same sort of thing at bottom.
All right. Well, it's the Wild Wild West, so.
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. And so, some of these photos are amazing. I mean, like, the one you took at the Knobsker, is that how you pronounce it?
Knobsker Hill in Bed and Breakfast. Yes, it takes a while to let it roll off your tongue.
To learn how to spell, by the way.
when you take these photos, I mean, did you notice this? There's one particular photo of a spectral, a sort of an apparition in the window, which isn't easy to see.
Which picture are you talking about? And my husband actually took that, and what he was actually just taking an exterior shot of the property, and he wasn't really taking that picture with the intention of anything showing up in it. And in fact, it wasn't until after we got home from that overnight that he noticed it. And I mean, that was one of those times when the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was glad that we were finding it at home after the investigation was complete, rather than knowing about it beforehand. And he just, because I sort of taught him, you know, if he takes a picture, just make sure he looks in all the windows and sees if there is anything there. And when it came, he's like, he came into my room and he was like, you know, you might want to come take a look at this picture. And so I looked at it and I was like, oh, wow. So I was really glad. I was glad, and I think that people will enjoy looking at that picture too.
Right. Well, you have some great evidence in this book. It's really amazing. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and tonight we're talking about ghosts, in particular the book Scare-Izona. That's Scare-Izona. Kind of a play on words, Scary Arizona. But put it together, it's Scare-Izona, a travel guide to Arizona's spookiest spots. And our guests tonight are Katie Mullally, that's Mullally, and J. Patrick Old, Olde. And their book has just been released by Shipper Books, who are actually very popular regional ghost publishers. So, and the book is really amazing, 250-plus pages with lots of amazing photographs and first-hand stories. So do you guys have a website, or how can people get a hold of this book?
Well, the website, it's www.whalingbansy.com, and I'll go ahead and spell that for you. The whaling part is W-A-I-L-I-N-G, but the Banshee part is B-A-N-S-I-D-H-E, so it's the old Gaelic way of spelling it. And, you know, that's just our regular website. There's a link on there that actually links me back to Shipper, so the book is available through our website and, of course, you know, on Barnes & Noble and that sort of thing as well.
Right, right. Now, if anyone out there has any questions for our guests, this is a call-in show. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions or anything you want to share, I'll give you the toll-free number right now, so grab a pen. The number is, if you want to call us, is 888-228-4494. I'll repeat that one more time. It's 888-228-4494. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Now, Katie, some of these experiences you wrote about were amazing. I mean, going to these haunted places and actually having experiences is really, I mean, just something else. And one that grabbed me in particular was when you were in one of these haunted hotels, I believe it was. I forget which one it was, but you saw a rocking chair actually rock twice.
Right. That was Nostr, the same hotel where we got the picture of the lady in the window. And, I was standing upstairs, and it was just, the whole place is just really intense. And it's probably my favorite place that we went to in the whole book because there was just so much activity. But we were upstairs, and I was actually looking in the corner, which would have corresponded to the window in the picture, and I felt really just like someone's eyes were just, you know, staring through me. And then it was then that I found that there was a rocking chair that was, you know, like a few feet away from me, and it rocked twice, and then it stopped. And I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to go downstairs now. So.
That's pretty amazing. So, Patrick, what were some of your, like, more intense experiences during your investigations?
My most intense would be also at the Nostr, because, again, that was just, of all the places that I've gone in my life, that was the most intense. And, you know, it was just, with that, there were a lot of, it was mostly the dreams for me when I was there. I would have really vivid, really kind of creepy dreams, you know, and it was like a lot of... you know, people standing around my bed or hearing children's voices and those sorts of things. And there was actually a moment where I had to go to the bathroom in the night, and I seriously weighed whether I wanted to, you know, which would be worse, being, you know, crossing the room and being scared or being embarrassed because I've, you know, wet myself. But I ended up going to the bathroom anyway. But it was a very, very, very intense place. You know, I would hear giggling coming from Michael and Katie's bed across the way, and, you know, I know what the sounds that they make when they sleep, and giggling's not amongst that. It was just there were just tons of experiences there that were just really, really very intense. That was by far the most intense and active place I've ever been.
Huh. So would you say that's Nostr Hill Inn Bed and Breakfast is the place to go if you want to see a ghost?
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, a lot of times people, you know, they see movies about ghosts and that sort of thing, and they get kind of the wrong impression about investigating, because a lot of times it's just wandering from room to room and writing things down on a notepad, you know, and it's not nearly as exciting as a lot of you know, movies portray it to be. But honestly, that place is the place where, you know, things from movies actually happen. It's really, really intense. There was another group that had gone there at one point, and they had to leave in the middle of the night because they got really freaked out by it. So, I mean, it's a very active place for sure.
Very interesting. Now, what are some of the other, like, really haunted places that, you know, people can go to?
I'd say that probably the next one would be the Jerome Grand in Jerome, Arizona. It's a hotel, but it used to be an old, you know, hospital, and it serviced the mining community there in Jerome. It's all built on a in the middle on the side of a mountain, so it's everything's uphills and that sort of thing, and the hospital there, you know, saw all manner of, you know, accidents and those sorts of things where people were coming in and, you know, from mining accidents and that sort of thing, and that place is really, really very active as well. You know, I've never talked to anybody that's gone there that hasn't had something happen while they were there, so that's another great place to go to in Arizona.
Wow. So how can people still be skeptical of ghosts when, I mean, there's so much research going on, and I mean, the evidence you guys present alone is, you know, pretty darn compelling. It's not, you know, conclusive that there's something going on. So, I mean, do you run into a lot of skeptics, would you say?
And we do from time to time, you know, and a lot of people, you know, take the kind of the line that they only believe what they can see and touch and hear themselves. And I'm not dissimilar to that, honestly. I kind of in the same way, but I just happen to have seen and heard and touched all of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, we'll run into people a fair amount where they're skeptical, but I think more often we run into people who are kind of afraid to admit that they believe in it or afraid to admit that they've had experiences because they're afraid people are going to think they're crazy. That, I think, is even more prevalent than you know, just pure skepticism.
Right. So have you guys, like, seen full-color apparitions of ghosts?
Well, I did at one point. Actually, it wasn't on the investigation, but I have seen, in fact, it was just, you know, it was right at the same time that my father passed away. So I actually saw, I don't know if it was him or if it was someone else, but I definitely saw, and it was just a, like a white outline of a person. So that's about as full an apparition as I've seen. I haven't seen anything that, you know, like in a haunting where you would see someone in like a, you know, a dress and, you know, carrying a lunchbox or anything like that. No, I've just sort of seen an apparition.
Yeah, me too. I've basically just seen apparitions, but I've seen a lot of them over the course of my life. But I've never seen like a, you know, an actual like residual haunting or anything like that.
Do you find that these ghosts interact with you at all?
The one in the house that I grew up in did for sure, because there were times when I would be sitting in my bedroom or whatever, and for whatever reason, he would never come in and into my bedroom. He would just kind of stand at the doorway, and there were a lot of times he would just kind of stand there and just, I guess, be watching me or whatever, and if I said, you know, knock it off, can you go away now, to him, he would go away. But, like, at night, if I shut my door, oftentimes he would open the door to, like, kind of look in or whatever. And so there were times my parents had stories about, you know, things that they were cleaning or taking apart where pieces would be missing and that sort of thing. So, I mean, that ghost for sure interacted with us quite a bit.
Right. Well, what would you say is your most common type of experience, you know, paranormal experience when you're walking through these places and investigating? How do the ghosts you most commonly manifest or make themselves known?
I think probably the most common thing would just be, you know, you get like kind of butterflies in your stomach or just feel the presence more than seeing or hearing anything. I don't know, Katie, what would you say to that?
That's actually, I would agree with that. It's just a sensation that you get. And I mean, different people will probably feel it differently. Like, you know, for me, it's like right in the pit of my stomach. I can just feel like something is there. You know, other people might get the hair stand up on the back of their neck, or like Patrick said, they might just get lightheaded or get butterflies or something like that. But that's probably by far the most common situation. You can almost, now I've become very tuned into that. So now even if I go into like, you know, a grocery store or something, if I have that feeling, I stop for a second and I at least have to wonder why.
Right. Well, the feeling of being watched, you know, is something I think that is going to be scientifically proven one day.
I hope so.
Now, another thing that I thought was interesting, you know, was the fact that you had the 22nd Street Antiques.
Yes.
Where there was haunting going on. Do you think it's because of the antiques themselves, or what is causing these hauntings?
Well, that particular situation, there was just so much going on. I think that the belongings, you know, just the general accumulation of stuff in the store was certainly contributing to it. I also think that the people that we spoke with are particularly receptive to that sort of thing. So that combination, you know, made it very active. So, you know, things that happened there might have been ignored by people that weren't really tuned into that, but because the people that we spoke with that worked there were, you know, it just seemed to be, you know, going on all the time. So, but I do think that the stuff that they sell there has something to do with it.
All right. Well, it's fascinating. Like some of the sounds that you guys have heard or, you know, gotten testimonies from other people, I've interviewed, you know, people who said that they've heard ghostly voices, of course, ghostly footsteps, but, you know, it goes way beyond that. People have told me about hearing ghostly piano music and all sorts of, you know, very different ghostly sounds. And I mean, one that you guys mentioned in your book was a ghostly typewriter. The sounds of a typewriter when there was no typewriter there.
Yeah, that was something that they told us that they had heard when, you know, at one point. When we were there, the top floor of the, there's like an annex. There's the actual antique store, and then there's an annex as well. And it was in the top part of that where they had heard that originally, because it used to have the vendor booths in there. But when we were there, they didn't have any of that. It was just an empty, unoccupied space. But they, I mean, there were many times when they would hear, the typewriter, or there was the stereo that kept turning itself up, you know, and they'd have to run up the steps and see what was going on, and there'd be nobody up there. And of course, you know, they'd turn the volume down or what have you, and then they'd go back downstairs, and just as soon as they get down there, you know, they'll hear it again, or the volume will go up again.
Right. Fascinating. You know, one of the places that's in your book, which actually I've heard about, I didn't know it was haunted, but I've always wanted to visit, was a Colossal Cave Mountain Park. And, wow, that's got quite a history. You want to talk a little bit about that?
I actually worked there as a tour guide for 2 years. And, you know, when I first got there, they told me, within the first month or so, I would start to, hearing voices and that sort of thing. I kind of blew them off. But there's a particular place in the cave that they call the Phantom Staircase, because if you go down there and just kind of stand, you'll hear somebody say your name. And sure enough, when I was in there for about a month or so, I started hearing voices saying my name and that sort of thing. And then I actually had an experience where I heard, and people reported this all the time, where you'd have a ghost tour where you'd hear an actual tour going on in front of you when there was nobody else in the cave. That happened a fair amount. You know, there was one particular morning when I was the first person in, I had actually unlocked the cave myself, and so I knew nobody else was in there, and I heard somebody talking, and I would hear laughing, and then I actually left my tour group to go check ahead, you know, in the room where the sound was coming from, to see if it was actually there, or if there was anything actually there, but, there was no one. And that cave had a lot of sounds to it. You know, there were a lot of people describing, like, you know, footsteps at various times, and hearing, you know, the ghost tours, or hearing somebody, you know, call them to, you know, come behind a rock structure or something like that, you know. And then, like, in the gift shop, if you, at nighttime, if you walked past it on a, you know, if you walked past the gift shop on one side, you could hear a stereo playing on the inside of the gift shop. But they got to a point where they wouldn't let anybody have a stereo in there anymore, because people were always running into check and unlocking the place and that sort of thing. But even once they removed all of the stereos, they would still hear, stereo music coming out. And, there were all kinds of things, like footsteps coming in to the gift shop. And just this whole area is very, very, very active. There was, for a while, the manager had a house behind the cave. Or it was behind, like, the kind of the guest area of the cave. Like, most people couldn't go there or whatever. But the house shared a wall with the cave itself. And one night she was trying to sleep, and her dog started walking back and forth next to the wall, kind of like sniffing at the wall. And she said that she heard the sound of kids playing on the other side of the wall. And the other side of the wall would have been in the cave. It would have been in a place that would be completely inaccessible to people, you know. So there's all kinds of those sorts of things going on in the cave. You know, it has a pretty rich history. You know, there's a whole bandit story where allegedly, you know, bandits buried treasure in there, and then, you know, the Hohokam Indians used it for a long time. Then the Civilian Conservation Corps came to, put in all the walkways and that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's got a really, really rich history, and there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Well, is the cave fully explored?
Yeah, it is, I believe. There's like about, I think, 2 miles worth of cave altogether. There's some rumors that it connects to another cave system elsewhere, but I don't think that's true, really. I've gone in caving in the kind of the wild parts of the cave, because it's only like a quarter of a mile that's on the actual tour, but the rest of it is all kind of wild, and I've been through a good portion of it, and I think it's pretty much they found all there is to find in there.
Well, it's got some amazing variety of activity. I mean, there was like some ghosts throwing rocks, I guess, you mentioned in your book, and people were seeing apparitions of Native Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a whole, down in the campground, not far from the park as well, there were people, there were, you know, a couple of kind of farmhands that were staying there at the ranch, described, you know, the rocks being thrown at the little shed that they were sleeping in, and there was apparently an entire, you know, dance going on in one of the corrals of Indians doing, you know, dance around the corral or whatever. So, I mean, there's a ton of stuff just in that whole area, you know, the cave itself, the campground. You know, there's a little girl that's been seen at the campground that's believed to be the daughter of a former resident there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff.
And unexplained fires as well?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, well, and there had been a fire there as well that had burned down one of the houses, I believe, that was on the property. And so there have been...
So it was either a house or a hotel.
Yeah, it was something
like that. And it was in that fire that the little girl died. The little girl that's often seen out there. So, they don't really know, you know, why it burned. Actually, no, it was a little girl knocked over a candle. That's what it was.
Yeah.
After that little girl's been seen a lot. I guess she wears a yellow dress, and a lot of the kids that live out there have seen her.
And in addition to that, there's the original owner of the cave, Frank Schmidt, who, there's dozens of stories of him showing back up to, you know, the management of the cave or the current owners and that sort of thing, you know, and people will smell pipe smoke walking around, you know, like if you go back to where the offices are and that sort of thing, you'll smell pipe smoke. There was a story where former owner now, because he unfortunately died, but Joe Meyerhauser was in the office. He just kind of acquired the cave and was kind of trying to clean it up, and the owner before him had kind of trashed it. And this rocking chair in the office started rocking kind of furiously or whatever, and he looked over it, and he said, it's okay, I'm getting everything cleaned up, the cave will be fine. And the rocking chair stopped, and he felt like everything was okay. But it seems like Frank Schmidt seems to be still wandering around there, making sure everything's all right. It was like a, you know, really big deal for him to get the cave going and keep it preserved and that sort of thing. So he tends to...
I'm definitely going to have to go there. I mean, you've got this awesome photo there of an orb right there in the cave. And amazing. Are you guys writing more books?
I'm sorry?
Are you guys writing more books about ghosts then?
Oh, absolutely. We're actually working on one right now that is focusing just on the Tucson area. And then that's actually almost done. And once that's completed, we are going to be looking in the Phoenix area, and we're going to be writing a book about the Phoenix area. So if anybody has any Phoenix ghost stories, we'd love to hear them.
Very cool. You know, I just love all the photos. I mean, the way you put the books together, it's really a great read.
Well, thank you.
So we're running out of time. We've got like a couple of minutes left. Do you guys have any like thing you want to tell our listeners about, you know, what they should do if they encounter a ghost or
take lots of pictures, and you know, just if you ever have any questions, you can always contact us or any other paranormal group, and they'll be able to help you with that. It's pretty much the advice I would give.
Do you want to give out your website again?
Sure, it's www.wailingbanshee.com, and that's WAILINGBANSIDHE.
Okay, now, what do you tell someone if they don't believe in ghosts? What would you tell them? That they said, no, there's no such thing.
Oh, I would have to tell them that they have to prove it, because I've already proven my case. I already know they exist, so I'd have to see their proof on the non-existence of ghosts.
Very funny. Very good. Well, guys, Patrick, do you have any last words?
The only thing I would say is just if people, you know, encounter ghosts or whatever, it's like, you know, a lot of people do, and you're not, it doesn't mean you're crazy, it just means that you've had a really common, you know, experience with a lot of people. It's one thing we found in all of our investigations is that all different sorts of people have the same sort of experiences, so that tells me that there's something there, and it doesn't mean you're crazy, it just means that you're having a common experience with other people.
Right. Very interesting. Wow. You guys are doing some really important research, I think, and I'm just so glad you're continuing to do it and writing more books. Well, that's all the time we have. So, Katie, Patrick, thank you so much for coming onto the show. I mean, I had a blast.
Well, so did we. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
We'll definitely have to have you on again when your next book comes out, if you're interested.
Oh, sounds great.
All right, folks. Well, that's our show for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed us talking to Katie Mullaly and J. Patrick Old, who have written an amazing book called Scarizona, A Travel Guide to Arizona's Spookiest Spots, which has just been released by Shipper Books. Check it out. I guarantee you, you'll be impressed. I really enjoyed the book, and I have read a lot of them and done my own research. And there's lots of new stuff in here you haven't heard before. So run out and buy it. You will definitely enjoy it. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you can join us next week when I bring on another exciting guest to talk about UFOs and the paranormal. Until then, have a great evening and a wonderful week. Bye.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone. And we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.